A few months ago, I was surprised to see Liv Ullman's picture in the newspaper, taken in Africa. She had her arm around a child suffering from malnutrition. Liv Ullman has added to her work as an actress the job of UNICEF Ambassador of Goodwill. Since her appointment to this position in 1980, she has visited UNICEF assistance rescue programs in Bangladesh, India, and Sri Lanka, and has recently returned from touring East African countries. She toured Angola, Chad, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. She's currently on a speaking tour trying to raise money for UNICEF aid programs. Liv Ullman first became known to most American filmgoers through her captivating roles in movies directed by Ingmar Bergman, which include Hour of the Wolf, Persona, The Passion of Anna, Shame, Scenes from a Marriage, Face to Face, Cries and Whispers, and Autumn Sonata. Her other screen appearances include The Immigrants and The New Land. Stage performances include A Doll's House and Anna Christie. 4 years ago, her autobiographical book, Changing, was published. She recently directed a sequence in the forthcoming film Acts of Love. This is a series of short segments written and directed by women about love. We're going to start by talking about her recent trip to Africa. Liv Ullman, it's really an honor to meet you, and I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Why did you decide to take a leave from your acting to do this work for UNICEF and to spend a lot of time touring Indian and African countries?
Well, I felt that my life has been so full of privileges, and when I got the chance to really do something with these privileges, as using my person not to talk about myself, but having media interest talk about those who cannot talk themselves, I just leaped on the chance, and I've had the most fulfilling year of my life touring these countries you talked about.
How does what you do when you're touring countries like this and coming back and reporting about it and the feeling of accomplishment and of really doing something that you get from that compared to the feeling of doing something that you get from being in a film that you know has really touched people in a very special way?
Well, you see, I feel that also doing this, you can touch people in a very special way, and sometimes maybe with more practical results for the people you touch. Because to show a person in a film is one thing. To show a person who's actually living today and who is in need of our recognition and help, that is something else, and to me at the moment much more important.
What do you do as a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF?
I travel in developing countries in the third world. I visit, you know, refugee camps, and then I go back to my part of the world, which is one-fourth the richer part of the world, and try to give people a motivation to why they should give, because it is hard to know why should I give if you haven't met any of the people you are giving to. But if I can present the face, a little body, behind the numbers and the statistics, you know, I have done my mission. I just have to say, when you mentioned the countries in Africa I've been in, I know about and have gotten information from those countries, but the countries I actually visited was Ethiopia, Somalia, Djibouti, and Kenya.
Sorry.
No, but the other countries are very close, and the situation there are the same as the ones I visited.
Was this trip and the trips before it your first encounters with massive suffering?
Yes. 1.5 years ago, I think, was the first time I really met a refugee. I really saw a refugee camp. I really saw what mass starvation is. I met Cambodian refugees in Thailand. In Hong Kong, I met boat people from Vietnam, also in Macau. And later I went to India and saw people who are not refugees, but who are lying in their own street, starving to death. And when I came over the initial shock, I felt that these people, I must do what I can to make them recognized.
So there's always that question, what can one person do, and how have you answered that question for yourself?
Well, I feel it's a person-to-person thing, as a lady said today, actually, when we were talking. You know, maybe one person cannot reach so many and do so much for many, but one person can at least reach one other person and make one other person reach a third. And I think everybody has means of showing compassion, either by, you know, giving money, by giving, you know, information, by writing their congressman. There are a lot of things that everybody can do. Because aid is really another word for compassion. And even if you have no money, you can show compassion.
The suffering that you've witnessed in the developing countries that you've toured have been caused by either natural catastrophes or by political disasters, suffering that was brought on by the acts of people committed against other people. Have you been investigating the political reasons for some of the suffering?
Well, obviously I do, because this travel has been enormously educational for me. I've met, you know, people from the government in each of the countries I go to. I've also met people from the government in the countries I later travel to tell about the destiny of the poor people. But since I am traveling for UNICEF, who is apolitical, it is very important for me to stress that I will not and cannot at this moment give political statements. We are there to help whatever kind of government these people have. And because UNICEF is apolitical, that also enables them to be one day in Ethiopia with their kind of government, and the next day to cross the border and go into Somalia and help there. That is two countries who are in war with each other. But if you come from UNICEF, that border does not exist.
But how has these travels affected your personal political beliefs and your way of viewing the world?
My priorities have changed enormously. What I found to be important before is so much less important now. And if you can say, you know, taking a different view of life is a political change, I have certainly been part of a political change personally.
Can you tell what that is?
Priorities have changed. I'm questioning a lot of things I've before wanted to do. And today I want to do different things. I'm not so interested even anymore to do acting. I'm enormously interested to explore what can I do as a woman, as a person, to, you know, make awareness both for myself and others, to make this life a better one, you know, and what are the causes? Try and explore the causes of these man-made disasters, and what are the causes and the remedy for the nature-made disasters.
The refugees that you spoke with, people in refugee camps, did they seem to have a strong political view of why they've ended up where they are and why their children are starving?
Well, I must say, you know, I came so loaded with, like, feminine questions to women in Ethiopia. Why is it that you work, you know, here in the camp and your husband does not? And why is it that your husband wants to have boys and not girls? But, you know, those questions you stop after 2 days, because what has priority here is, will I have a meal tomorrow? Will there be water here tomorrow? Is there any way my child can get help from a doctor? Is there any way my last child will survive? You don't ask political questions. You don't ask feminine questions. You just answer their cry of help. And they are not, you know, asking who did this to us. They are really just saying, remember me. Remember my child.
How do they regard you? I mean, you're really a stunning and white woman. And you will look very different from the African people.
Well, you see, there is much less barrier actually there than there are sometimes here when I come into a party, and the barrier is immediate because I'm an actress and they want to know about, you know, my films and things, and I don't relate to the women as sisters, if you can use that word. But coming there, although I look different, immediately it is like there is not that barrier. I'm a sister. I'm a white sister with blonde hair. They have seen, you know, mostly white people before. And those who haven't, they are not questioning the color. They see the sex and they take your hand and they take you into, you know, the shelter to show a sick child. They see I'm coming with the airplane or the car which is delivering food. So they know I'm part of some kind of aid, some kind of hope. So they sort of approach me as somebody who might do something for their situation. But mostly, they really, you know, approach me as a woman. And I am so moved and filled with that, you know, that at last another woman is touching me and is, you know, stroking my hair because it is different and allows me to stroke her cheek because I'm moved by her story. That she shows me how she's making food, if they have food, that I show her the material on my dress, that even without language, we are closer and relating more direct than to many people in my world. The barrier comes from me, not from them.
So being white and being a film star just doesn't affect that relationship.
Oh, no.
At all.
First of all, they wouldn't even know what a film star is because it's so far removed from what their reality is. And the color is really not part of it, you know. If anything, it is my sex. You know, I would see that I more easily than some of the men who would be with me, you know, get an immediate contact because it's woman to woman, and it's child to woman. It's child who takes a woman's finger and walks around, or the woman's hand to show her something. Or it's children suddenly enormously happy that here's a grown-up who wants to run and play with us, you know, and make a joke with us. But never, never did I feel wondering about the color coming in.
You make it sound like it's almost a relief for you to not be Liv Ullmann, famous screen actor.
Oh, yeah, it's an enormous relief because as much as you struggle, you know, to keep your own identity, it is difficult in my profession because people approach you differently because you are a celebrity. It's wonderful, again, to be Liv and be taken for face value. I'm no more, I'm no less. I'm blonde and my skin is pale. But, you know, hello, I'm a woman. Hello, I'm a woman in Africa. Or I'm an old man in Africa, and you seem to be a woman I can talk to. This is my story. And it's so heart-giving to me that I could be Liv again. I think that is one of the reasons I'm so eager to continue my work.
You've had a very rich life in your film experiences and your personal experiences, and I wonder if you felt any guilt at all having so much, and I don't just mean materialistically so much, but having so much knowledge and experience. Did you feel guilt when you encountered, you know, thousands of suffering people in one day?
I felt enormous sorrow. I think maybe I felt more guilt before when I was leading this kind of life. Why is it that I have so much and, you know, other people don't have these opportunities? But I think guilt is a dangerous feeling because it's a prison for love, really. And love never emerged out of guilt. But love does emerge, you know, if you feel sorrow, if you feel compassion, if you feel that you recognize this human being as somebody who has the same needs as yourself. I felt enormous sorrow for them, but I've kept out the guilt, you know, because we are trying to do our best, and we mustn't think that we can immediately change our complete life, you know, give away everything we have, you know. I don't think that is the first priority. The first priority is to identify.
So guilt is not a useful thing to feel, but if you are feeling it, are you able to just throw it away and get rid of it? Or do you just simply not?
I'll try to translate it into something else. Obviously, I feel guilty. Obviously, I feel guilty when I'm sitting in a plane that is taking me from enormous tragedy into complete freedom of privileges. Of course, I feel guilty, but that guilt is not the thing that is going to work.
Where did you stay when you were traveling?
Well, you see, because I worked for UNICEF, and UNICEF is working so closely with the different governments, UNICEF is a very welcome guest within the country. And the government themselves, they put you up in, you know, official buildings. You get a room in a state house or something like that. So it doesn't cost the people of the country we're coming to any money. Also, traveling, you know, airplane tickets, you very often get free from the airlines. And within the countries, you know, you travel with the food truck or the airplane which is delivering food. And I think that's very important for people to know that those who travel and just observe the way I do, for example, for UNICEF, obviously we don't get paid for it, and obviously the trip itself is not taken away from the aid money.
Right. You talked about the generosity of some of the people who you met when you were traveling, and how someone who had nothing or next to nothing might offer you some of the little food that they had, or like the only ring that they had, and offer to you as a gift. And that really puts you in a funny position, since, I mean, you had access to food and you have plenty of material possessions, but a gift is such a wonderful offering, it's sometimes very insulting to turn it down.
I know. And you see, in the beginning, because I'm coming from where I'm coming from, where we are so awkward about giving and sharing, we are awkward about receiving. Actually, the first time it happened to me was a little orphan girl in Calcutta, you know, in one of Mother Teresa's places, who gives me a ring off her finger. And because I'm so awkward, you know, my mind is just full of, you know, oh, can I take it? And I immediately took off a bracelet I had and gave to her, because I have not learned the grace of receiving or of giving, you know. For her, it's just such a natural thing. You know, this woman liked what I was having, you know. It just follows with the thought. And that is something I've learned. They are not giving to get back immediately, and they're not used to awkwardness of, you know, refusing and long explanations. I have so much. If you get a shared meal from somebody who has only that meal, I think you share it, and maybe you go back and you share many meals with other people on behalf of her.
I'm talking with Liv Ullman, and she's now a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF, and she recently returned from a tour around East Africa. And I just want to give you the phone number for the Philadelphia Area Committee for UNICEF if you'd like any more information. It's 922-2265. Did what you saw when you were traveling, is what you saw when you were traveling something that you're going to be able to draw on when you start acting again?
Well, you know, acting is really, at least for me, has been, you know, drawing on what you have experienced in life. What you are showing on the stage or on the screen is who you have been in life. So obviously part of that will be, you know, my acting. But there is no way, you know, they have been my material and now I will go and use it. Actually, at the moment, I find it so hard to envision myself in front of a camera.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think because I felt, you know, this is important and this is a life. You can move and you can touch people in a film or on the stage, but sometimes with what you're moving them and touching them with is not what is going to help the people who are 3/4 of our world and who are the ones who have a terribly bad time.
Did something happen in your life that made you really feel this mission, which you seem to...
No, not really. No, well, I was part of a group of Broadway artists who were, you know, collecting money for Cambodian refugees, and we were working for something called International Rescue Committee. And when I was the one who gave the check to the head of that 1.5 years ago. And, you know, I said, as you always say, you know, very politely, if you can use me, just tell me. And a month later, I was in Thailand because they didn't take it as a politeness for my sake. They thought I meant it. And even if I hadn't meant it, you know, there I was in Thailand. There I was meeting children in refugee camps and seeing them sit there, have nothing to do, maybe have no future, no food, and still seeing these smiles and this generosity. And yes, that changed my life in not an enormous, miraculous way, but in a small way. Because, you know, like somebody said when I went on that travel, they said, it take you a long time to get over that. And what the truth is, you never go back from such a travel ever. I think you continue one way or another, always.
Many of the roles that we know you best from are roles in which you use your skills as an actress to express great internal suffering. And I'm thinking here particularly of Bergman movies, where the suffering was the spiritual void within, and it wasn't famine or being a refugee. A very different kind of inner suffering, a more spiritual or intellectual conflict. How do you relate to that kind of suffering, having come out of the suffering that you did in your travel of developing countries?
Well, I think that is one of the difficulties, because how am I going to relate to an intellectual suffering that Mrs. Johnson, you know, is going through this trauma? You know, I think Mrs. Johnson might be really helped by helping somebody in Africa, and I think that might be the solution to her problem. And then to use 3 months going through Mrs. Johnson's problem, you know, showing it on the screen, that is going to be hard. But on the other side, we are people who have had so much, Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Ullman and you, that maybe if we can, you know, get some more knowledge about our own trauma, we will be able to be more giving, more accepting people. So maybe for that reason, you know, it will still be important to do films about our own traumas, maybe to enlighten ourselves about who we are, and thus maybe be able to show more character.
It sounds like those internal turmoils seem superficial to you now. Did they when you were filming them?
No, because once you take on a work, you know, you have to make it important as well you can, and that didn't seem superficial. And as I say, you know, like I said, I think guilt is a kind of imprisonment of doing things. I think neurosis is also another kind of imprisonment. And maybe by dealing with that in ourselves, you know, to a bigger degree, maybe we can, you know, open up, have more of the freedom, have more of the things that people in developing countries have kept. You know, it's not that they are more because they are poor. I think really we had so much material things happen to us that we lost abilities. Children, you know, they lost the art of playing. You know, there's a whole market for children toys, children dresses, you know, everything for children. They don't play with stones anymore. They don't see, you know, a fairy in a little tree, because everything has been given to them. Fantasy has been taken away, you know. Responsibility has been taken away. Old people has been taken out of their lives because we send them to nice, decent old people's homes. The family is sort of deteriorating. And I think maybe by making films showing the vacancy within us, you know, might make us wake up again and leave the television set to speak to a friend.
Since, again, getting back to some of your screen roles, they were about questions of faith or lack of faith. I wonder how, I don't know if you consider yourself a religious person or not, but I wonder how your experiences affected your faith or your kind of inner questionings about why people exist and why people suffer.
Right. Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. I believe in God. I find it hard to understand why somebody would have a life like that, and my life is so good. I don't know the answer to that, but I know in the field there are so many people working as volunteers and, you know, in aid organizations that are enormously devoted to God. And if they still believe in God after really being in the field, doing the field work, doing the really hard work, if they still believe in it, you know, there must be a reason. So I look to them, and you know, I hope they have the questions. I mean, a woman like Mother Teresa certainly believes that there is a divine force, although she is every day having in her arms dying people, just to give them the last minute of grace in life, which they never had before.
On the screen, you have such an incredibly expressive face. I mean, that you can use your face to describe so much that it would be even difficult to describe in words, again, some of the conflicts from within. I've always wondered what you thought about and what went through your mind as your face revealed all of this.
Well, I'm trying to think of the situation, you know, if she's sad, I'm not having my own sad thoughts, but I'm trying to, you know, be as open as I can to what does sadness look like, to try and feel sadness. And thus, if you really think it, feel it, it will show. It's making it that won't work, you know. If you try to make tears and agony and think of your own dead grandfather, you know, I think that's a kind of cheap way of both using real emotions and of using yourself. It's like I'm a director of myself, you know. I'm thinking all the time, and it's always she, which then is me, you know. Oh no, she's really upset and show it, and she's banging her head. Oh, that looks really good. It's like I'm, you know, standing on the side. I love it for the kind of technique. This is film, you know. It allows me that the camera can come very close, and I find the ways of feeling so it will show in the face. It's difficult to explain. I think acting technique is very difficult to explain.
Do you use your face differently on the stage than on the screen?
Yeah, on the face you can't feel. On the stage you can't feel. On the stage you have to project, because, you know, you never have an audience 2 feet away from you. On the stage, you know, a movement of sorrow is one of both a sad face and a sad body, a hand that will give a gesture of sorrow, and words of sorrow that cannot be whispered. They must be projected so people in the gallery will hear it as well. That is another way of technique you have to use, and also interesting. Also, the audience are very much there, part of, you know, what is happening. If they are quiet, they create a kind of atmosphere that the two of you have together, you know, one of quietness, listening, and then it's, you know, fun to show them what this scene is about.
Do you usually feel satisfied when you look back at the rushes or the final movie?
No, I almost never feel satisfied. That's also a very frustrating thing. Movies more satisfied than in the theater, because all the time while I'm on the stage, I'm thinking, oh no, I didn't get this right, and no, I missed this. And when it all is over, you know, I suddenly think of, why didn't I do this? And it's always leaving with frustration, feeling I didn't do enough. And these people are paid and they're not coming back. And can I run after them and tell them what I really wanted to do? It's frustrating. And maybe it's in some terms self-involved, I don't know.
Can you think of a scene where you felt that it wasn't exactly what you were after?
You mean in, well, I know, like a musical I just did called I Remember Mama, you know, but there I felt I wasn't supported by the words either. I knew so much what I wanted to do with her. It was an immigrant woman and her children and her husband, you know, very simple, but with one dream, that her children would have a better life than she had had in the old country. And I felt I had no words to support me, because the words were, I don't think, greatly written or very deep. And the scenes were not there to support me. And I myself was, you know, more thinking of overcoming than being that woman. And I felt very seldom that there was a chance to show a real woman like that, you know, who was part of what built America, one of the immigrants. Was my lack of knowledge of a musical, and it was, I think, to a high degree, lack of effort by the people who wrote the musical.
I guess that was frustrating for you.
Oh, I hated it. I hated every moment of it when they gave me these lines that were so untrue. Yeah, that was frustrating. And that was one of my main reasons, actually, for feeling theater is not real enough for me. You know, this is not true. I'm not allowed here to say words I believe in, so why should I do it?
You know, I've always wondered, you work for so many years with such a real master of the medium, Ingmar Bergman, and where do you go after that to find someone with a comparable understanding of the medium that you're working for?
That is a problem, because, you know, there are other wonderful directors, and I worked with some of them, and I'm eternally grateful for that. But, you know, there are so many who are ill-prepared, who go there for the money, and that is hard to take after having worked with Ingmar, who works so hard in preparation, and he comes to the studio or to the stage each day and has really read and knows what the whole thing is about. And, you know, he lets everybody do their work at the best, because he himself has created the framework for that. But then when you meet a director who is not prepared, who's not done his homework, you know, and then he sits there and you hear what he's saying, he's improvising at the moment because he has no idea of what he really wants. I mean, I'm too grown up. I don't have time for that in my life. If he wants to have a workshop, I mean, he's not doing it with me.
Well, you've just had a chance to write and direct a sequence for a film that I think will be opening soon, called
Acts of Love.
In the autumn?
Yes, it's six or seven women who have written each segment of love, and some of us directed it. And all the segments are very different, I understand. I haven't seen them.
You wrote one segment?
I wrote one.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, it's an old man. You see him in the morning. He's waking up. He's all alone in a double bed. And then you see his lonely morning at the breakfast table. But at the same time, you see it's like he's preparing something, you know, in a little basket. Then you see him making himself beautiful, and he's going for a love visit, you understand, although he's 8 years old. And then you follow this little lonely man on the streets and then into a big institution, a hospital, and he comes into a room with other old ladies. But there's one lady there who makes him really smile for the first time that day. And she is gone. You see her eyes are just looking at the wall. And he sits down and he's brought food. He's spooning her with soup. He has a wonderful little serviette he puts under her, or bread. And he holds her cheek and he looks at her with such love. And then he's brought water to water a flower. Because I remember when my grandmother was in an institution, they didn't let her have flowers because the nurses, they have so much to do, they didn't have time to water it. And this man, I think maybe he asked to have the flower there and promised he'd come every day to water it. And then in the end, he sits down and he reads from the Bible. That's the first line in the film about love, what love is, that love endures everything. And love in this case endured that she left in her mind. He's still there to take care of the love the two of them must have shared together. And then he leaves the hospital And that's the story.
You directed the sequence too?
Yes, I directed it. And I actually loved directing, because the two people who played the two old couple, they're both more than 80 years old, and they allowed me, or the man even asked me, you know, he said, can't you talk to me during shooting, because I don't remember everything, you know, you say, take this bread here and fill that thermos there, and, you know, it's much better if you talk. So it was like in the old days, you know, instead of music, I could just stand there and he was so lovely, he was so real. He himself had an experience with a woman who was stroking, you know, so he knew what it was about. And I could say, you know, when he was pouring soup into the thermos, you know, he started to shake his hands. And I saw that the actor got embarrassed. And I could say during the take, and look, you're shaking, you know, and you want to feel that thing. And you are so upset because you are so old and it's shaking. Use it. And, you know, suddenly he used the shaking. It became part of him. And when he came into her, you know, I could say, oh, that lovely smile. Look at her. She is the one you loved. And I was sort of participating with him. And I just, you know, if directing could be that, I'd do it, you know, all the time, but there are very few actors who would like somebody talking to you during takes.
Were you ever directed that way?
No, never. And you know, actors are not children, because actors are... Neither was this old man. He just asked me to do it because he forgot when to do this and when to do this, and we did long shots. But actor, basically, you know, they like to think out their own things and show their own fantasies, what they have understood from the script. And a good director will allow them to do that. A bad director will always try to put himself in the actor, and, you know, why should he use an actor? He should play it himself then.
You know, I read your book Changing about 4 years ago, and I don't have a very good memory, so I don't know if I made this up or if this is really in the book or not. But I have this memory of Bergman telling you something before shooting one day that really upset you, and the look of upset or confusion stayed on your face and was there for the shooting, and that was a way of getting that look. Did I make that up?
Yeah, you might have made it up, because I think one of the things where he is so good, he's not tricksy with the actors. You know, he looks upon them as grown-up people with a profession. And there are directors who, you know, will say, you know, I upset them or I pinched them. Like, you know, it's children or cattle he's handling. And then they will go and they will do it right. Bergman actually believes that if he gives them a good script and good blocking, you know, and listens to them and watches them, they will perform, you know.
So you'd never do anything that, that as a director?
No, and I would never dream of it, you know, with like this old man who was so wonderful. He knew much more about being old than me, about having a wife in that situation than me. And for me then to fool him, to try and make him look differently, I mean, that would be so... terrible. I mean, on the contrary, you know, I just asked him to again do what he felt, and it was seeing what he felt that I could start building on that. You know, the performance in the film was built on what he knew, not what I knew, and not what I had pinched him to do.
No, but as an actress, you've had to perform a lot of roles where you didn't necessarily, I think, ever experience exactly what that person had experienced, unlike this man who had an experience very close to the one that you had cast him in. So what do you do when it's not enough in your own realm of experience to completely comprehend motivation or emotion that character would be feeling?
Well, I think you always draw on life. And, you know, whatever I do, I will always be playing a woman, you know. I will always be playing a woman my age. So whatever I have experienced somewhere can be used into the experience of this woman, although I haven't had this. I never tried to commit a suicide. I was never a murderess. I was never this or that. But there have been parts of my life where the emotions I had then can be drawn on. And also on people I met, on other women I've met. And basically the woman I am showing is a woman whose face has to be my face, whose body has to be my body. So obviously I also have to use what's inside this face and this body.
Visually, what were you trying for in the film, in the sequence that you directed?
Very simple. I just wanted to show the loneliness of the man. I wanted to show the institution, how cold and hard that is, and the image of him holding her cheek, giving her the spoon of food, and the love of his eyes then. And she being gone.
Was it different for you to watch something that you had written and directed than it is to watch something that you are in?
Yeah, it was very different. I watched it with I look at myself also when I see screenings with a kind of cold eye. But this was in a way, actually, I look at myself colder than when I looked at this. I must say I was much more satisfied with this directing thing, although it's very simple, it doesn't mean a thing. But, you know, because there I felt, I saw what I had tried to do, whereas very often when I looked at myself acting, because I had never seen it before, I was always on the other side of the camera. I've always been disappointed, because I always thought while I was doing it, so much must show, because I'm feeling so much. And mostly when I see it, I think, oh, it's that again, you know.
What are some of the other things that you maybe drew on in your directing from Bergman's directing? Did you draw on anything that you learned from him?
Yeah, the respect he shows actor, you know. I wanted to show the same respect and confidence in them, because he has really taught me how important that is, and I know how confident I always have been on his set as compared to other sets, and I tried to do that to the actress I was working in.
Do you think acting will be different for you having directed?
No, because this experience was so short. It was a short film. No, acting will be the same, maybe. More boring.
Are you going to be coming to Philadelphia next year to perform? Or did I make that up too?
You made that up too.
Oh, this yes. is wishful thinking, I yes. guess. You're living like part of the time in New York and part of the time in Norway. Do you feel like a citizen of a particular country, or do you feel more like a world traveler now?
I feel, you know, I don't know if I'm almost American or Norwegian. What I really feel is like somebody who's very, very happy living in America with Norwegian roots and going back to Norway. But, you know, I feel enormous love for your country. I identify very closely with your problems. And sometimes, you know, people get upset because I am criticizing things in your country, and they say, how can you do that? You're not American. It's only that I forget that I don't have the right, because I do feel this country has given me so much, I've found so much here, and I feel, you know, thus I have the right to criticize too. I feel Norwegian with the nature, with the seasons, with the references which were those of my childhood. I feel American very much, that here I would like to work, I would like to spend my days here. But still, it's a question whether my daughter feels the same.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we are living together, you know, we move back and forth according to where the needs are.
Have you
biggest.
Ever? I'm sorry. Yeah. Have you ever felt a part of like the Hollywood scene, or would you ever want to be a part of that?
No, I've never felt part of it. Even when I lived there and worked, and I would never want to be part of it. Oh no, that would be very difficult.
Why?
Because, again, it's priorities. You know, I could never identify with what was their priorities, and I could never identify with what is a star and what are the values, you know. You're considered box office or not, or, you know, what is the surface value of you? How old are you now? You know, these things, you know, I'm much happier not having to cope with it. Maybe because I'm not box office, maybe because I'm not beautiful, maybe because I'm not young. It's easier what I've chosen.
Well, you know. But you're beautiful, and I mean, I think you're box office also, but it's not cleavage box office. It's a different kind. There's different kinds of box office.
Yes.
I mean, you're of actresses with like intellectual appeal, or, you know, just conceptual appeal. I mean, you're certainly and beauty combined with that, you're, I think, extremely high on everybody's list. So I'm sure your box office.
Yeah, well, I'm not the Hollywood idea of
box
beauty
office,
and sex. You know, even
you're not
being
Hollywood
a
idea of beauty, you think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the films and the way women are used, luckily, no, there are, you know, so-called stars, you know, that are different, like Jane Fonda, Glenda Jackson, you know, Shirley MacLaine, women who have both the age and you know, feel something for their own sex, but they are far outnumbered by, well, I won't say names, but other women.
What kind of roles do you get sent by people who want to cast you?
Peasants, neurotic women, women who are our queens or something, you know. Costume pictures. A lot of pictures from the war, you know. Escape pictures from camps, you know. Things like that. Unhappily, I get very few pictures which would say something about a woman today, my age. In Europe, that would be easier for me. In America, obviously, those pictures would go to an American
woman. What are some of the things you'd like a movie to say?
Something about you and me, something about realness, something about a choice of values, you know. Something which made you go out of the movie house and feel you have learned something, not necessarily something boring, but you have just changed a little. I mean, a movie house is still the only place where people really can meet and there is an exchange of feelings. And it would be wonderful if they went out enriched and not just, you know, feeling they were Charles Bronson and who shall we know, go and fight down.
So what do you look for in a script? What it has to say and how it says it?
Yeah. You know, and as I say, being an actor is not having the choices to always look for this in the script, because first of all, so very few scripts have this. And being an actor is like any other job. Sometimes you do what you are, you know, offered to do. But, you know, being an actor is also the possibility to say no to something you know will be discriminating or, you know, negative or dangerous for the people who watch it.
Well, earlier today you said you thought it would be difficult to imagine now being in front of a camera again, and I really hope that, and I think I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of people, that you continue to, and I know it's none of my business, but I certainly hope you continue to do films and certainly stage as well. And I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. It was really a great honor to meet you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was nice being here.
I've been speaking with Liv Ullmann, and we've been talking about her acting, but we were also talking about the work that she's doing now as a goodwill ambassador for UNICEF. She's been touring a lot of developing countries, and it's apparently really changing her life a lot. And I'd like to give that phone number again for the Area Committee for UNICEF in case you're interested in contacting them. The number is 922-2265. And if you're interested in seeing Acts of Love, which is this film of segments written and directed by women, it should, I guess, as you said, be released in the fall, and I'll look forward to seeing that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 3:10, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.